My name is Paul Williams. Our title this evening reflects modern anxieties about the level of religious involvement in the political spheres of life. The term radical is being increasingly used by secular authorities to describe those of the religious persuasion who dare to desire a link between their theological beliefs and an epistemological basis for governing human societies. The debate today is not literally whether God himself should be de-radicalized. Rather, it's about how far religion is and should be involved in man's social life. The question of whether God, whether you believe in him or not, should be de-radicalized is a moot point, considering that it is the human perception of how far God should penetrate the affairs of man. This question forms the basis of contemporary discourse that activist secularism and political theism seek to influence. In essence, today's debate focuses on the key question: should society keep religion separate from the state? This event is hosted, as I said, by the Muslim Debate Initiative, or MDI, which is an intellectual, political, and theological initiative formed by experienced Muslim researchers, debaters, and speakers, aimed at encouraging inter-community debate, discussion, and dialogue. MDI believes that only through frank and open discussion and debate can a deeper understanding be gained, relations between different communities be improved, and hopefully the breaking down of prejudice and false conceptions. It's with this in mind that we invite our honoured guests to come and present to you today's event, which is entitled Should God Be De-Radicalized? On my left-hand side is Abdullah. He studied computer science at the University of Hertfordshire and specialised in social, professional and ethical issues of information systems. Abdullah is a former Christian who embraced Islam at a young age and has studied Islam in depth since he was 18. Abdullah has had a long experience in working for Islamic revival and the establishment of Islamic Sharia in the Muslim world. His activities involve speaking at community centres, universities, colleges, and appearances on various TV programmes. He has experience in debates with atheists, secularists, Christians, and has been involved in public and radio debates with atheists and Christians. On my right is Bob, who studied philosophy at the University of Warwick and at Queen's University in Canada. He worked in communications and marketing, then systems development, before joining the British Humanist Association in January 2008 as the membership and web manager. He now liaises with local humanist groups, manages membership communications, and has been responsible for the VHA's online presence during the Atheist Bus campaign, which you may have heard of. He has represented the VHA on radio, television, and has discussed philosophy, religion, values, and humanism in public debates and interfaith forums. The event this evening will proceed as follows, and this is what the speakers have agreed. There will be an opening presentation by both speakers on their respective views on secularism and political theonomies. This will be between 20 and 25 minutes each. After that, there will be an informal discussion, which will be about half an hour in total. Then there will be a break, much needed I'm sure, for about 10 minutes. And then after the break, there will be a Q&A session with comments also from you, the audience, which will last half an hour, 40 minutes or so. And that's a very important part of the evening, I think, is your own participation in this evening's event. And then there'll be a brief summary at the end from each speaker. Now, I'd like to explain a bit about the rules this evening. And I'm sure we're all very civilised, so this is just a formality. No one shall shout, jeer, or disrupt the speakers while they are speaking. Anyone who wishes to make comments should save them for later during the audience participation session. Applause is allowed at the end of each speaker's session if you feel so moved. And we would like to remind everyone that in accordance with the Islamic principles of Muslim Debate Initiative and the commonly understood principles of the etiquette of discussion, that we should respect everyone's right to hold opinions and express them, even the most unpalatable ones, as long as they are expressed sincerely and for intellectually serious purposes, and not gratuitously and in a disrespectful fashion. We hope you enjoy this evening and gain a deeper insight into the ideological, theist, secularist dialogue and debate. And now, without any further ado, I'd like to present the first speaker, who is Bob.
Hello. I think it's interesting what you just said there about the sort of rules of debate that essentially we've evolved and come upon as society has got better at talking to each other. I think that the nature of debate is adversarial, certainly this kind of formal debate. We're pitching ideas against one another, and I think that there's a tendency to think of it in terms of someone winning and someone losing, rather than as an attempt at understanding or even as an attempt at getting at the truth. I think we have to accept that there are implicit consequences of our positions that the other is obviously not going to like very much. They are mutually exclusive viewpoints, perhaps, and we'll find out where they are and where they're not. So it's naturally going to follow, from perhaps from Abdullah's point of view or from someone's point of view, that as a non-believer in God, I lack some faculty for detecting the divine. As someone who's unable to see himself as living in a divine world, then from that perspective, implicitly, it seems that I've obviously failed in some sense, and I'm not saying you would say that or put it in that way. It just seems to me a natural and implicit consequence of your position, if that's what it is. And likewise, as a non-believer, I'm obviously not going to believe in the divinity of the Quran or the Hadith. I'm not going to, there are aspects, there are going to be religious beliefs that I think are dumb. I mean, I think we should admit that and just say that. There's obviously a very tight mutual exclusivity between a lot of what we all think. With a bit of an attempt at coming to this notion of sort of understanding, rather than just trying to sort of bash each other and win something, I'll talk just briefly about what I see as humanism. So you have atheism, which is not believing in God. For me, what marks out humanism are two assumptions. One is an assumption that something, so if you like, it's an assessment. And another is an assumption of something, so it's an undertaking. The assumption that is that we are alone, in some sense, that humanity, there's no higher layer of meaning and purpose over and above us that is controlling us, that we have one life to live. The assumption is of responsibility for ourselves and our individual actions and for each other, and for humankind and for the world. So we have these two assumptions, the assumption that we're alone and we have one life to live, the assumption of responsibility. Now, obviously, you could have the first and not have the second. There's nothing to force somebody to elect to be responsible for themselves and for each other. And very often people will say, without God, how do you get to that responsibility? God surely is the thing that to which we are responsible in one sense, that from which we inherit our notion of moral responsibility. And the humanist position is kind of saying, well, actually, I don't think that is the kind of thing that responsibility is. Responsibility is something that can be inherited, but it's also something that you can elect to choose yourself. We say, I'm going to take responsibility. And that, in a very sort of broad nutshell, I think, captures something of humanism, that we choose to take responsibility for ourselves. We're not commanded to do so. There aren't things set down that we're challenged to must submit to. So we've got this question of should God be de-radicalised? Obviously, there's lots of different kinds of radicalisation. At the British Humanist Association, we work quite closely sometimes with Ecclesia. They're a Christian think tank. They are anti-clerical. They're outside of the church. They're very liberal Christians, if you like. They're radical in one sense. Certainly, a lot of the rest of the church will regard them. A lot of the church will regard them as very radical for being outside of it. Obviously, in one extreme, extremism, kind of terrorist jihad, that's going to be pretty radical as well. Another kind of radicalism is more the radicalism of someone who's just passionate and committed to their religion. I think often when an atheist is sort of saying, I don't believe in that, I don't believe in that, because if you're religious, this is the source of your morality in some sense. It feels like you're being attacked for that, perhaps. That someone is getting away at the foundations of your morality. And I think I want to be very clear that that's not a kind of radicalism that I would want to attack in and of itself. The idea that someone is committed to a search for the truth, committed to answer philosophical questions, committed to being moral in some sense. I mean, we might disagree about what that means. But that radical commitment to, not so much to particular beliefs, but to the attitude of wanting certain discourse to play out, that's not a radicalism that I want to attack in itself. I think the radicalism that's been alluded to, and that I don't want to put any words in Abdullah's mouth, but that will, he may come to you later, is this, as was said, this kind of politicalized religious radicalism, where we're talking about religion and religious belief, not just as an aspect of your individual social and personal life, but in some sense as being predominant in the political sphere. So what's the opposite of that? What's if we talk about secularism keeping away religion from certain aspects of politics? Well, when I talk about a secular state, I definitely don't mean an atheist state. I'm not talking about a state where the Home Office, in some obscure way that I can't even imagine, is atheistic, or the immigration services are atheist. That's not what I mean by a secular state. Also, what I mean by a secular state is not a secular society as such. I don't mean that everybody is secular or atheist and that that's somehow going to be enforced. That's not a secular state either. A secular state is about a certain neutrality on questions of both religion and belief more generally. I think it might be helpful to bring in a sort of distinction between what's sometimes called French secularism and Indian secularism. And it's a pretty rough model, but the idea is that perhaps that the Indian secularism, the model is supposed to work such that everyone is free within the society to be religious. The state itself is not discriminating against any particular brand of religion. In France, you have that harder line that sort of says, no, there are definitely areas of government from which religion is prohibited. So, for example, you have talk in France, banning the burqa has come up again, and certainly in schools already, in public schools, a much harder line on religious uniforms that we don't have here. I think that Britain is kind of halfway between in a lot of ways. So what do we mean by neutrality at the state, at the institutional level? I think people usually make a distinction between public and private values. So the secularist, the person who's in favour of the secular state, says, you know what, there's the public stuff and there's the private stuff. And you can keep religion in the private space, and it may well enter the public space, but you can't have any privileges in the public space. So the public space then becomes governed by a sort of minimal set of shared values, and those may include tolerance, willingness to accept differences, allowing others to hold and follow their own beliefs and ideals. I think there'd be a lot of minimal political values in any secular state like this. Equal citizenship, liberal democratic rights, such as freedom of speech and assembly, the right to vote and stand for office, principles of social justice, such as equality of opportunity. So if we've got that minimal notion of a secular state, the secular core of these principles and values, well, how minimal actually is that? I mean, the first problem that someone who's suspicious of secularism may have is that this is highly contentious already. Perhaps respect for diversity and democratic rights and social justice for some radical religionists would be liberal values already that are already in conflict with some of their own religious principles. So I'm going to kind of sort of combat that problem of contentiousness with four general arguments. None of these arguments are intended to be exhaustive. They're definitely not going to convince everyone. I do not think that there is a knockdown argument for secularism. I don't really think there's a knockdown argument for anything that is going to convince everyone all the time. But there are four arguments that I think push people towards it. We live in a plural society, and we all have to live and work together. So the first argument against this problem of the contentiousness of the minimal values is the argument from fairness. Given the diversity of religious and non-religious beliefs, no group should be receiving a privileged domination over all of the others. This is where philosophers start talking about social contract theory, to really bond in those that minimal set of values that allow us to discourse and evolve and share ideas together. John Rawls in The Theory of Justice, talking about social contract theory, introduces this concept of the veil of ignorance. What kind of state, if you were behind a veil of ignorance, perhaps in some sort of magical pre-birth state, and you're going to be dropped into one society or another from behind this veil of ignorance, you don't know yet what religion you're going to be in. You have no idea. You've never heard of religion. You haven't, if you think that a particular religion can be deduced a priori out of nothing, you haven't had time to do that. You really don't know what religion you're going to be. What kind of minimal state do you think you would like to be dropped into, John Rawls says, from behind this veil of ignorance? And obviously the assumption he's making is that most people say, okay, I'm going to need a bit of freedom within that state to make up my own mind. I don't just want to be dropped into a state or into a society that has such a fundamental assumption of any beliefs that I'm not going to have any freedom to move or to come to my own decision. Of course, so I think that that argument, it kind of works when you think about being dropped into a uniform society. But what if we're talking more about societies that are already themselves pluralistic? I think there's an argument that works just as well on a uniform state as on a pluralistic state, which is the argument from autonomy. Locke talked about autonomy as a sort of... you have people, faith schools, for example, that literally see their job as to indoctrinate children. When asked, how much freedom do you really give them to think for themselves, they say, well, not much, this is part of our job. It's certainly not the view of all faith schools, but it's one way of thinking about it. John Locke said that without a certain degree of autonomy, without being given the apparatus to make your decisions and form your opinions for yourself, then obviously any claim to faith is going to be a kind of a lip service and certainly not going to be very strong at all. You need that autonomy if you value faith, if you value that faithful commitment, that submission, whatever it is, then obviously it needs to come from an autonomous place. In this autonomous state within a secular state, obviously free and open discussion is going to be part of that. And that will allow for discussions on contentious moral issues like abortion or assisted dying. It will allow for discussion on things that I consider imaginary moral issues like gay rights or homosexuality, more generally. That place for discussion it doesn't become moot, but in fact autonomy is what guarantees that it can take place. The third argument is the argument of pragmatism. Now, again, not every religious believer who is in favour of a sort of a theocratic, anti-secular state will accept this kind of argument, of course. They may say the godless must accept their fate. But on pragmatic grounds, I would argue that in a very Hobbesian kind of way, that without minimal agreement on how we can talk to each other within the state, things lead to all-out war. I mean, we can see that secular constitutions, the notion of what really sort of cemented secularism in Europe was after the Catholic and Protestant wars in the 17th century, huge, long, bloody period, you started to see secularism come in as an antidote to provide that framework on which discussions could go back and forth without everyone killing everyone else as king. Obviously, there are lots more examples currently in the world of the same kind of internecine conflicts between denominations or between different religions, for which having that shared ground, that shared middle space for Hobbes would be an antidote. Paradoxically, I think that the intensity of religious belief, the extent to which people are very likely not to want to give it up just because someone else throws a different belief in them or a different argument, isn't a good reason against this pragmatic argument. It's something that really drives it. The more passionate people are, the more unwilling they may be to give ground, the more it becomes important. Fourth, I'm going to talk about the argument from human nature. So this is an argument from the facts about human nature and from the conditions for human flourishing. Mill in On Liberty said, human nature is not a machine built after a model and set to do exactly the work prescribed for it, but a tree which requires to grow and develop itself on all sides according to the tendency of the inward forces which make it a living thing. Human beings can change their minds, think of themselves, grow restless and evolve both individually and culturally. Any alternative to an open society under a secular state severely risks stifling these propensities for growth and change. And while so many describe it purely as conservatism, that tendency away from any kind of secular state I can only describe as anti-human, to the extent that it runs against that human nature for change and self-determination. Okay, so we talked about this problem of the contentiousness of what the minimal space can consist of. I'd also like to talk about the problem of the minimalism of what those things are. So not just about their content, these principles that underlie a secular state, but their actual contents and the fact that maybe there's not enough of it. So another argument against the secularist would be, look, I don't want a sort of vague mishmash of secular principles as the state. There needs to be much more in the way of positive value that we can all get behind. Now, I think that this actually exists. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say it's part of the state itself, but I don't deny that there are greater positive shared human values that actually pretty much most people one way or another converge upon. So we all value in different ways intimate relationships, the pursuit of art and beauty, knowledge and self-knowledge, the value of the natural world, meaningful work and creative accomplishments. These are things that definitely get hashed out in different ways, have different rules for how we engage with them, but things that we all tend to value. If that private-public distinction that I'm sort of airing out there, so I'm saying, you know, we do have in the private world a much greater set of shared values, but in the public space we still should keep this minimum set of secular principles. That may sound too divisive, right? Okay. There's too many different things there in that separation. But the secular state doesn't preclude the idea that your private values and hopes and dreams and whatever are also forming your activity in the public space, your reason for engaging in civic debate or in the political space can very much be motivated by the private values. Just separating them out and saying this is the secular state doesn't preclude that. I think that if you reject the argument from fairness for a secular state, then you need a homogenous society complete with some kind of underclass status for anyone who's outside of the particular state religion. If you reject the argument from autonomy, you have a society of indoctrinated people, or people with little choice but to pay lip service to a belief. A society where free thought and criticism are quelled in the religious and political spheres is a society frozen in those spheres, a society of moral inertia, of vast political corruption, always required to maintain a bastion against open dialogue on fundamental principles. If you reject the pragmatic argument, you'll have states in international warfare, bloody internecine wars between religions. On pragmatic grounds experienced from history, it's simply impossible for me to take seriously the idea that anyone has ever possessed a perfect set of rules of interpersonal behaviour, and that if you were in charge, if your version of Sharia or any other system were in place, then the state would fall into an ideal sort of utopian line. Someone somewhere has already tried more or less what your version of a non-secular theocratic state would look like, whatever your version is. And I don't see any happy, productive, idyllic, thousand-year-old religious states out there. If you reject the argument from human nature, I think you're bound to fail. Again, we don't have a magic recipe for prescribing exactly how human beings can be treated and channeled, for how human beings will definitely get along with each other. We, the people, are simply not amenable to this perfect once and for all vision of an unchanging polis in accordance with your theocratic principles and beliefs, again, whatever they are. I'm going to stop there.
Okay.
Welcome to everyone, and thank you for coming.
I'd like to thank you all for turning up. I thank Macbeth for turning up and giving this discussion a good hearing and a good kind of debate and discourse between us. Like you said, the aim today is not to just have debate so that one can beat the other or score points or so on. I don't view us as adversaries, I view us as advocates. What we are advocating are two different ideas, and we are trying to present these ideas to you. You are the judge, jury, and executioner, and so on. I'm hoping with the executioner, in a different sense. So in that way, we're just basically presenting two ideas, and I think I'd like to, I mean, there's many points I'd like to address in Bob's talk, but because obviously this is just a presentation, we'll save it for the very interesting discussion after this. But I'd like to present my viewpoint towards the concept of secularism, where it came from. Is it something that agrees with human nature? What is its effects? What are its premises, its basis? And also, what is the alternative? Now, I don't advocate some turban-ruled state whereby everyone is under the stick and is threatened with instant execution the moment you drop a crumb. What I'm advocating is something perhaps which a lot of you are unfamiliar with. And it was a very revolutionary concept which 1,400 years ago, and it created a lot of progress and development, a lot of which the scientists, the Western world, the Enlightenment thinkers stood on the shoulders of the thinkers of this civilization to produce the Enlightenment itself. So without which there would be no Enlightenment, it is argued. Now basically, the basis of secularism. What if someone came up to you one day and said, whatever you believe in, be you atheist, theist, Buddhist or Christian, whatever denomination of theist, or just a general atheist, you believe in the universe exists, or it's eternal, or it's made from the universe, or it's changed, and so on, various, whatever beliefs you believe in, whatever created us, whatever mechanism was in place that produced us, our place in the great scheme of things, whether you're an atheist or a theist in this, has absolutely nothing to do with your life. Now, if someone told you this, that all this, or where you came from, or what created you, whether it be evolution, dialectical materialism, if you're a communist, a god or whatever, if someone said to you, yeah, all that has absolutely nothing to do with the way you live. And you said, well, do I live in a different universe or something, a different dimension, where I was caused, or what I'm part of is completely detached from where I am existing? Say, no, we exist in the very milieu of existence, of the cosmos, or so on. So whatever affects, whatever was the cause of us, or is the process by which we were produced, is still ongoing, it's still there, we are still existing, and we are part of this, and so on. And as I said, whether you're an atheist or a theist, you can all agree. And it would make no sense to say you make a detachment. And this is why people say that maybe secularism versus, let's say, a political theist debate is like an atheist versus theist debate. I say it's not. If I was a communist, I would still be here debating or discussing or arguing with my friend. I would say that the universe is evolving. We are all different evolved pieces of matter. And our purpose is to head into the future, further evolving, and we have to integrate that idea into our human affairs, into an organized human society by that principle. And I'd be a complete atheist. Because at least with the communists, they attach their belief of what created them or the big cosmic picture to their life's affairs. That makes more sense. I mean, I can debate that, I don't believe that personally, but at least it's logically coherent. But to say there's some now disconnect between that doesn't make rational sense. And that is a problem, that we need to compartmentalize our mind in order to be a secular. So we can go out and live our life, and then, but we keep religion for a certain place, or we keep our belief in atheism to a certain place. We don't basically implement it. It's like some people used to call communists atheist extremists, or atheist radicals, because they believe that atheism is the truth, and should be mankind should be ordered according to that reality. Now, so much is the connection between what you believe in about the cosmos, where it came from, and how you live your life, that it was said by the Russian philosopher Mikhail Bakunin, the first revolt is against the supreme tyranny of theology or the phantom of God. As long as we have a master in heaven, we will be slaves on earth. So he obviously is an atheist. He believes that we have to get rid of God, because if God exists, then we are under his commands. And if he does not exist, then that's the only time we can ever say we are free. Although, I wonder if you find the irony, you know what would happen after he died in Russia, what his country went to in terms of ideologically. Now, in terms of the other problem with secularism, this is perhaps old hat to many secularists who've heard this, the morals and virtues are essentially arbitrary and relative. Now, that's just a statement I'll put out there. And I say it's arbitrary and relative because there is no epistemological basis for why you should make certain values, certain moral, a value or a moral. It's just there. The Prime Minister says it, that sells it, we believe it, we implement it, that's it. There is no reason. Now, there are various arguments put forward, such as, morals are in our biology, are in our DNA, and so on. But the problem is, if morals are in our DNA, then this makes us no different to animals. Animals also have DNA, and they're also creatures like us. So, but for them, whatever gets them to survive, to procreate, and so on, is the most successful strategy. So likewise, we should adopt the same very logical strategy, which is to survive and procreate, even at the expense of others. Not that we would go out of our way to do it, but if ever someone gets in our way in terms of for our social advancement, we should basically deal with them because they're in the way of our social advancement. You see, this makes more logical sense. Again, Michael Ruse, a philosopher from the University of Guelph, says, the position of the modern evolutionist is that humans have an awareness of morality. Because such an awareness is of biological worth, morality is a biological adaptation no less than our hands and feet and teeth. But then he continues, I appreciate that when someone says, love thy neighbor as thyself, they think they are referring above and beyond themselves. Nevertheless, such references are truly without foundation. Morality is just an aid to survival and reproduction. Any deeper meaning is illusory. Now, this guy is not a theist, but he's talking about evolution, and he's saying that our genes are part of our morals are part of our genes. The other aspect where morals could come from is just society itself. As in, you're born to society, and society told us from a young age what is good, what is bad. Your parents hit you when you did something bad, or you hurt your sister, and they rewarded you when you did something nice. And then that kind of becomes ingrained in us. Now, most of us here have learned morality by this way, whether you're atheist or theist. But the problem is, over time, us being thinking creatures, when we get older, we question why something is wrong. Why is it wrong? For example, why is it wrong to steal? If the person is rich and I'm poor, why not? What's wrong with that? Maybe I need a bit of fortune in my life. Why does a rich person have to have money that I can't have? So these are things, again, morals that secularism can't justify. Again, we'll probably debate this, and this is obviously a source of much contention. But again, to quote Richard Taylor, an eminent ethicist, who said, the contemporary writers in ethics who literally discourse upon moral right and wrong and moral obligation without any reference to religion are really just weaving intellectual webs from thin air. And also, if you want to argue down the line of, well, maybe, whatever society says at any point in time is right or wrong, fine, society becomes your quote-unquote God. But if you go down that route, then how would you address the issue of, in World War II, the Nazi Germany, when it became morally right, by virtual consensus of German society, to kill and execute Jews and communists and so on and so forth? Then that would be right, according to that definition. But we say that it's wrong. Now, I've met some relativists who are so stringent in their belief, they say, yes, that was right then, but now it's wrong now. Okay, I credit them for being consistent, but it's very dangerous, that kind of line of thinking. So then, secularism has certain points that it puts forward as just arbitrary, complete arbitrary. For example, George Holyoake, who wrote his publication, English Secularism, he defines secularism as essentially having three central principles. One, the improvement of this life by material means. Two, that science is the available providence of man. And three, that it is good to do good. Whether there be other good or not, the good of the present life is good, and it is good to seek that good. That's a bit of a tongue twister. Say that five times fast. And that's funny, because Richard Dawkins says there is no right or wrong, no good, no bad. So that means that George Holyoake was saying it's good to do good, but that has absolutely no meaning. And the French lawyer and politician, Simone Weil, said, to set up as a standard of public morality a motion which can neither be defined nor conceived is to open the door to every kind of tyranny. Now, these are the points that morality or these good deeds or so on, which this current society says is good, has no basis for it, and it is prone to being changed. In 20 years' time, what was bad today would be good, or what was good today would be bad, it would change. 30 years ago, it was immoral to be homosexual. Today, it's moral. So morals change, because there is no basis. You haven't anchored them down anywhere, but they will constantly change. So that's one problem, the issue of morality. Also, where does secularism come from? Now, whenever I speak about secularism, I always emphasize that the West are traumatized. They are psychologically traumatized. They are traumatized by the Dark Ages. They've never got it out. Christianity has not got out of their skin. No matter how atheist someone is, Christianity is still there, and it irritates that person. And it's like he's got some post-traumatic stress disorder regarding for Christianity or religion, because of what happened during the Dark Ages. And based on this, the Europeans thought, why are we so backward? You know, ironically, they saw this advanced civilization in Spain, which shall remain nameless at this point in time. Advanced civilization in Spain, why are we so backward and they're so advanced? Why is that? You know, and they read their books, or wow, you know, this science and inquisitiveness and criticism, critical thinking, wow, why is it that we can't do this? Whatever they did, they would get punished or accused of being heretics or heresy and so on. So they determined that the reason why they're backward or why they are culturally stagnating is because religion is dominating over them, i.e. the church. The church is basically having political power over them. So they thought, we'll get rid of that, and we will base our belief on natural law, and then we will progress. Yes, religion is the problem. That is the problem. But the real problem is that across the Mediterranean, it was quite the opposite. The pagan Arabs, before the coming of a particular religion that won't be named at this point in time, they were quite secular. They were very much worldly. They were mercantile. Some were nomadic, some were sea dwellers, urbanized and sedentary, and they were mercantile culture. And religion was kept on the side, whereby you do your business. When you want a successful business transaction, you go to the appropriate god, give some small donation to that god, and then hope it goes well, and then go back to your business. And that was it, really. It was a virtually secular society. And what did one particular person, who again will not be named at this point in time, do, is he talked about that God exists, and that God has a purpose for mankind. And that all these other small gods, or the gods of tribalism, or the gods of your inherited culture, which has no basis behind it, just superstitions, These are false idols, and the real God, the real absolute reality, is the ultimate cause for everything that exists. And this ultimate cause created us within this scheme of things, and we have a purpose upon which to proceed. And the moment that the Arabs learned this, their whole civilization changed. Suddenly, they became advanced in technology, science, development. They became master critical thinkers. There was simply no limit to what they could achieve. They achieved certain architectural feats which have only just been surpassed in the modern day, including what they call nanotechnology in terms of sword making, for example, which again I'm not going to go into, that's a technical discussion, but nanotechnology. Obviously they weren't manipulating atoms, but they developed structures as small as nanotubes in terms of in their metallurgy. So they didn't believe the Earth was flat. They were measuring they were predicting sunspots, sunspot activity, while Europe was still debating whether women had souls. And that is it. So we didn't have any problem with religion. In fact, religion was the cause of our progress. And it wasn't just a homogeneous society. We also had different religions. In fact, we started out having different religions living amongst us, and we negotiate a way whereby they can be accepted for what they believe, have what they believe be recognized in the public sphere, and given a place in the public sphere by a method of negotiation, which is something which the writer William E. Connolly, a political philosopher and so on, in his book Why I'm Not Secularist, also discusses what we should do for today's world is have a process by which we mutually negotiate with each other based on recognizing who we are, our identities. Now, there are a number of points which, again, I'm going to bring up during the discussion, which is the issue of fairness, open society, cohesiveness, and the ontological concepts of secularism. And I'll discuss all these points. Again, some I think everything he's already mentioned. But the historical basis for secularism is based on an assumption due to a very limited bad experience. It's equivalent of me, basically, let's, for example, or any one of us, let's say you've had a bad relationship. Let's say you're a guy or a girl, and you've had a bad relationship. And you say, oh, damn it, that my partner was really bad, that's it. I'm never going to have anyone from opposite sex ever again, they're too much trouble. What would you advise this person? You say, that's just one bad experience. You're just the wrong man or the wrong girl. Yeah, mate, find the right man or the right girl, then it will work. Likewise, because the particular theology that was existing in Europe maybe caused you to have these problems. Why don't you just try another one? That would have worked, perhaps. That would have perhaps led to some development. And again, you know, I could argue that because secularism is based on that premise, which caused it, it is false from its conception. Likewise, I could say that because all political systems are attached to the time and context, I could argue that since that situation in Europe was 200-300 years ago, I could argue that secularism is obsolete and requires a new system to be implemented because we no longer have such an ecumenical body dominating over the political life of people. Likewise, a few points before we get into discussion. One, secularism says that religion has different ideas of religion and we can't all unify. Secularism is something that we can all unify on. That's great, but which secularism? Is it soft secularism, which I'm assuming that's what my colleague Bob believes in? Is it hard secularism, which is what the French model? Is it secularism which means that separation of law from religious grounding? Is it secularism that means just science replacing superstition? Is it secularism that means the shedding of old traditions and embracing new ones? Or is it secularism that means that separating religious ecumenical institutions from political power? There are so many definitions of what is secularism that secularists can't even agree what is secularism. In Turkey today, there is a power struggle where people are getting locked up because one group of secularists are saying that their belief is the real true secularism, the other one is saying, no, it's not, and then they are locking each other up for being anti-secular. You see, this is happening in Turkey. It's divisive. It's divisive. So again, there's no unity on what is secularism, let alone which school of thought of secularism you follow. That's a whole different discussion, different schools of thought. Likewise, the issue of equality. In terms of secularism, yes, equality exists, as in by law, there is established something called equality, but there's a little problem, and it was highlighted by the philosopher Fish, which I'll mention very quickly. He said, fine, I think it's fair to distribute goods and privileges equally, irrespective of the accomplishments of those who receive them. You think it is fair to reward each according to his efforts. I think it is fair when everyone has the chance to speak. You think it is fair when only those who are qualified have a chance to speak. The disagreements between us cannot be settled by the invocation of fairness, because what divides us and our differing views is what fairness really is. And likewise, equality, what do you mean? Legal equality? Economic equality? Or the equity whereby those who have advantages are rendered to help those who have the disadvantages? And so on. What do you mean? Humans might be equal in idealistically, but in practical-wise, we're not equal. Some are more intelligent than others. Some are more stronger than others. Some come from richer backgrounds than others. You know, there are various differences, obviously different genders. We're not exactly equal. We're not some, a homogenous gender and all the same size, like we come out of a factory. We are all different with different strengths and weaknesses. Any system that does not recognize that is doomed to be oppressing human beings by allowing them to the strong to oppress the weak and the weak to be exploited by the strong. And to finish up, I'll merely say that other points I'll cover in the discussion, but essentially, I hope that through this discussion, we can all come to understanding that it's time for us to consider a new system to save prison. Thank you.
Thank you, Arthur. Right, we now come to that stage of the evening, which is called the informal discussion, which will be approximately 30 minutes long, and after that there will be a break. So I will now invite two speakers to have this informal discussion, and I've been asked to moderate to ensure balance, but I'm sure there'll be perfect gentlemen, so it won't be necessary.
I think in what I said before, it was quite clear that this notion that philosophical beliefs should have absolutely nothing to do with your life was not in the version of secularism that I'm talking about. I spoke about how the private motivations, including religious motivations, should, of course, inform upwards into sort of political and civic actions. It's not a secularism that is supposed to be bleeding us dry of our pluralism. On the contrary, it is a secularism that is enabling us autonomously to express our pluralism. It's not a secularism that believes that we are all equal in the sense of being functionally identical in every capacity at all. I mean, that's obviously not what we mean by a civic equality. It's about an equality of citizenship. So I don't in my life compartmentalize the way that I think about a sort of broadly civic action or political action away from my humanism. So if I go and give blood or donate time or money to a cause, I do sort of think about it in those terms. I mean, I'm not saying that everyone should or needs to. I think most people are actually very capable of understanding concepts like justice and the redistribution of wealth without having to go to some like deep philosophical well. For me, I have these humanist motivations. I don't feel like an anti-secularist for having those, and nor should someone who's religious. So I'm not in favour of this compartmentalism that you were sort of suggesting.
Sure, but would you not agree that if you believe, I guess what Rawls refers to, John Rawls, who's a political liberalist philosopher, political perfectionists, those people who essentially they connect their philosophical beliefs about existence, or their ontological beliefs, or and so on, and they connect that to their political opinions and beliefs and so on, they let it colour their opinions towards human affairs and society, that would you not argue that this is who Rawls actually criticises? Because you mentioned Rawls, and I don't know if you follow him, but surely you have to leave your philosophical beliefs at the door when entering into the public space and just agree on some arbitrary set of values upon which we can all play the same game, so to speak.
Okay, I don't think that they're arbitrary. I think that the reason I went through these sort of arguments for what the minimal values, in a very broad sense, I mean, obviously, you know, they weren't cashed out in sort of definite legal terms, but this very broad set that just to allow this interchange of free ideas, the kind of rules we adopt to have a debate like this, I don't think that they are arbitrary. And no, I don't think that you have to leave your philosophy behind at the door. In a sense, the secular space is a theatre on which you're coming in to play particular roles, based on the beliefs that you have.
Sure. I was reading this book published by the British Humanist Association called The Case of Secularism, A New State of Modern Society. I recommend you'll get it. It's an interesting book. But in it says that you are allowed to participate in the public sphere, and you're allowed to make a case for a particular interest, but the case has to be made according to, I guess, a materialist-struck benefit approach, as in how it benefits the society, how it benefits the individuals involved, as opposed to bringing your own theology and saying, well, my God says this, and this is my case. For example, I'm against gay adoption. If a person was to say this, I'm against gay adoption, and I'm against it because my God says it's not allowed. Let's say that the Catholics, in a recent situation. Now, the book, obviously the organisation, maybe you disagree, perhaps, but it says that you can bring your contention, but you have to frame it as a kind of general contention, which is not linked to any particular, again, philosophy or religion, just a, well, I don't think it'll be hygienic, or I don't think it'll be psychologically beneficial, or I don't think, you know, it has to be framed like this. Would you not agree then that this is forcing people to, in a way, cover up their philosophy and put a different face on it just to get their interests or to advocate their interests in society?
I do disagree that that is what the case for secularism, the book that you have there, says. I mean, certainly it talks about how if you are bringing your beliefs, if you're bringing your position into the open secular theatre, then you can, by all means, make a case in religious terms. But if you make a case, an example I can think of from the book about abortion, and you make that case in terms of the sacred divinity of the soul, well, obviously, because that is certainly not a sort of shared principle, I mean, most people would disagree, even if they agree that there is a sacred, you know, divinity of the soul, would actually disagree about what on earth that means. I mean, to me, it's fairly meaningless, and I think that although it may have distinct meanings for different people who do assent to it, it's not a very accessible empirical way of getting to the nub of a particular issue. So I think that yeah, there is an expectation that the secular minimal state is not forcing people to speak in non-religious terms or ways devoid of that. But of course, if I make a case based on an assumption that you don't share, well, of course we're going to disagree immediately. I mean, it's really about trying to boil things down to assumptions that we do share, rather than just block. I mean, in both directions, rather than in just blocking off public debate altogether and saying no, you can't bring those religious principles in here, in my house.
Sure. So to see if I understood, essentially, you are allowed to mention the reason why you have your grievances, but no one will basically take it seriously because it's safe to cite.
Not that they won't take it seriously, but I mean, if I start talking from an assumption that you disagree with, then presumably we have to sort of go, okay, well, let's try and find some different assumptions to get to the same conclusion. I mean, the example you gave of the adoption agencies, I think, is a really good case. So equality legislation was going through, and the Catholic adoption agencies, which actually amount for a relatively small proportion of adoption agencies in the country, but have, for historical reasons, dealt with more extreme cases, so they were reasonably important. They said if we don't get what we want out of qualities legislation, if we're not allowed to continue, despite the fact that we receive public money, to discriminate against gay people, then we will close. And a lot of them have closed as a result of failing in this request for an exemption. A few of them have changed and become secular, so they are no longer the St. Mary's adoption agency or whatever they've changed. Now, I don't see that as a case of them. They made a case on religious grounds. They made a case on grounds of conscience. And what happened is that the state said, actually, we've kind of put this legislation together now. And they listened to the exemptions. I mean, boy, did they listen. There was a huge Catholic lobby trying to be exempt from equalities legislation. I mean, in a way, I mean, to me, that's itself kind of interesting. You know, we as a secular, broadly secular society are coming, trying to deliver an equality legislation purely about protecting people's rights so that they can engage with civic society in institutions paid for by public money. And a church says, oh, we don't want to be a part of that equality. We don't want to be a part of that progressive movement towards everybody having the same rights. So yes, they ended up losing the argument. Effectively, I think it was one Catholic adoption agency which is still sort of clinging on, saying we are discriminating against gay applicants and that it's sort of unresolved, although the situation may have changed. I do not think that this is a case of a secularism bludgeoning away religion. In any other sphere, when we talk about rights coming into conflict, I think most people understand very well that the right for me to swing my fist stops at the end of your nose. We know that whatever rights we have, whether it's movement or expression of a religious principle or belief, that it stops at the point when it comes up against someone else, when it now takes something away from somebody else. It's like the first thing that people think about and learn about when they come to think about rights. But it seems like in the case of religion, we have this blind spot of like, well, hang on a minute, I must be allowed to discriminate, to prevent people from engaging actively in the civic arena, because it's an expression of my religion. So I think it's a really odd approach to society, frankly, to think that someone can take public money paid for by everyone and run an adoption agency with one of the rules being that not everyone in society can actually take part in it.
Sure. Again, 2 points. One, what if they were run by the church's own funds and so on? The law would still apply to them. And number two is that these people are individuals. And in a way, I've always thought secularism kind of idolizes the individual. But the individual must basically compromise for society, for society's sake, which is quite ironic considering that it's a society based on individualism. I mean, is this not different to, is this not similar to, say, in communism, whereby the individual must basically bow down to the will of society and so on, and can't be an individual, express individuality? If he doesn't believe in something, then why must he be brought under the yoke of it? And I want to make a point on this one. You said that if you do something that affects other people, let's say hitting them, and this always comes down to physical violence examples, then fine, you know. But human beings have more than just a relationship of physical touch. For example, if I could be a millionaire and make loads of money on the stock markets and deprive people of their pensions, totally legally, completely legally, I could, you know, banks can collapse and, you know, people can become poor because of my, and I can get stinking rich because of my actions, but it's completely legal because I'm still legally equal to the poor person and I haven't physically hurt them. But when they are being evicted out of their house and they don't have a place to live and so on, and they're on the streets, that's unfortunate, but that's okay because I'm not physically harming this person. You know, and likewise, if I want to, let's say, slander someone, well, let's just not say slander, let's just say I will misrepresent someone in society in a very careful way, then only the rich people can basically get legal redress against me from the slander and libel laws. If you are poor, and I put you in the newspapers as, let's say, I say you're a terrorist, and everyone hates you, and you're not, you're completely innocent, and you know, the police haven't arrested you or anything like this, but this newspaper has, you know, libeled you, you can't do anything because you don't have the money to redress your rights, even though the newspaper, you could argue, has not physically hurt you. They haven't hurt you. Yeah. Your reputation's gone down, you might not be able to find employment, but physically you haven't been harmed. And do you think the argument of physical violence is the only defense, or the defense that is enough to deal with all the other issues which are also violence, but not in a tangible sense?
I think that you've just made some sound arguments in favor of reform of financial regulation and reform of libel legislation, but not against secularism. I don't really see how that argument is supposed to work. I mean, this notion of my right to swing my fist stops at the end of your face. I mean, it's an issue about rights coming into conflict, and the whole point of using that is that when someone's right comes into conflict with another, we should stop it at the point when it seriously damages those other persons' rights. Sometimes we have very difficult legal situations where it's not really about rights. Like you don't have a right to bank as such. Your right to be a banker is coming off lots of other rights. You don't have a right not to lose your money. But the point is that the principle stands. I agree that it's one person's action coming into conflict with another's, and I completely agree that in some situations we need laws, regulations, whatever they are, that prevent people from doing that. But that doesn't contradict the principle of a secular state or an open society.
Well,
it's a good way of handling one.
Well, I thought that in secularism you believe in generalism. You know, secularism has kind of, liberalism emanates from secularism, and the freedoms and positive freedoms of the individual come out. So
they're certainly bound together.
Yeah. So freedom of expression. So one could argue that. I should be allowed to libel as many people as I want. And if I'm, for example, if I want to do that, then that should be okay. It's freedom of speech, it's freedom of expression. Because I'm not harming them physically.
Yeah, but not all rights are about physical harm. I mean, so okay, you can so it's defame more than someone or harass them with abusive hate mail or something. Those are aspects of free speech which would be coming into conflict with their rights to live a peaceful life. And again, I don't see how that. Those are perfectly good arguments for, you know, having systems in place, but not against having secular systems in place.
So you're
more fundamental political level.
So you're for the issue of people shouldn't do damage emotionally and physically to other people, or even a harm or
I mean, I
restraint.
Guess
or
there'll be situations where maybe you're stuck in a moral dilemma, and whatever you do, you're going to hurt someone. That, I mean, that could be a situation, or moral dilemma where it's going to be severe detriment to you, or a minor inconvenience to someone else, and people would have to make a moral decision about them, which they did. I mean, I think it's very interesting that you've come back around, in a sense, to very human notions of thinking about morality, thinking about law, trying to make them work with one another. Not necessarily sort of, we get back to sort of basic principles of fairness when you've been talking about people infringing other people's rights and so on. I think that it gives the lie to the idea to bring the subject onto something else that you said in your talk, to the idea that under secularism, morals and values are arbitrary and relative, that we think that when the Prime Minister says it, well, it must be true. I mean, that's certainly not a very open society kind of thing to think. It's not a very, again, it may be confusing two things, like there's political secularism and there's a sort of an atheistic or a humanistic moral philosophy. And I think those are two distinct things. Now, I would defend the atheistic moral philosophy. I think that, as I said, I don't believe that we get our morals from God. I don't think God commands us to do them. I don't think that would help or be particularly moral anyway. And I think it comes to a very fundamental difference between a sort of a religious outlook and a morally secular outlook, is that we disagree not about whether whether morality is absolute or not, or objective or not, and mostly we don't disagree on the actual principles that are at stake, certainly around the fringes, yeah, but the real difference is that I don't think that it has to derive from something. I think that morality is a worldly thing, exactly in the kind of discussion we were just having about laws and rights. It's a negotiation. That's what morality is to me. So I think that we have very different ideas about what it is. It doesn't mean that it's relativistic. Like, this is, often this is the sort of slip that's made. If it's not fundamentally derived from God or some purpose-giving abstract layer of meaning, then it must be relative and pointless. I mean, that's not what objectivity philosophically is. It doesn't always have to refer to God or something outside of it. I mean, this table presumably is objective. I can't know it. We have lots of philosophical arguments about hypothetical doubt, maybe it isn't really there or whatever, but that's one notion of objectivity that doesn't have to refer to God, doesn't have to refer to beyond. Another notion, if you're playing a board game and there are certain rules and strategies in place, then I could be playing against someone and you could see, someone could have lost the game before anyone notices that they're there. So it's not a subjective thing. It's not about what's in their heads. There's no particular idea of it. The objective fact that someone can't possibly win the game anymore can be true purely on the basis of the sort of nomology of the game and its rules before anyone notices it. That's another kind of objectivity. I think the morality is much more like that. I mean, this idea that atheists cannot have an objective morality is wrong. It's just that we have a very different concept of it. We conjecture protocols of behavior, we conjecture values to hold, and we evolve and see how they work, we negotiate with them. I mean, I actually think it's not just philosophically coherent, it's a much better description of what blatantly goes on in the moral sphere. That is clearly what we do.
Sure, but the table doesn't tell you what's a good way or a bad way to employ, what purpose is a good way. Should you use it to cook your food on it? Should you use it to, have a debate on it? It's just there, it's an object. It can be used for different things. The different things you want to do have values that you give to them. But where do these values come from? Now, obviously, if you're hungry, then obviously you might use it to cook if there's no kitchen around, for example. But that's a bad example. But why someone should be, let's say, altruistic, selfless, as opposed to someone being selfish or individualistic. And again, secularism is all about the individual. Its philosophical basis is the individual. There's no rhyme or reason. In a way, you could say religion is counterintuitive. It says that you're going to get no benefit from this, but forgive someone or give your enemy something. Give, and help your enemy.
That's completely counterintuitive. Any person, or any man of logic would say, that's silly. You know, why are you going to help your enemy for? He hates you, and you're estranging him, and he wants to do bad things against you. For example, it's counterintuitive. Yet people do it because they have a belief in the metaphysical, and that's why they do it. Whereas a person who is more physical, shall we say, will say that it's irrational to help your enemy, it's irrational to forgive someone who you have good reason to dislike. If you separate metaphysics, what you're left with is the physics. And the only good and bad in physics is what is possible and what is impossible. That's the only good and bad. So that's why, I didn't want to turn it into one of those, you know, atheist fears debates, because that is what's always been debate, you know, is our morals delusion. But I don't want to debate that much, because I wanted to talk about the political philosophy. But when I brought up these issues regarding how in this society, why you see these contradictions, are because these are contradictions. It's not like, well, we're debating on a human level now, and I'm bringing up, you know, mutual values. No, what I'm showing you is that the contradiction within the society regarding, reconciling two mutually rights, the right to freedom of speech and the right to, not be harmed or emotionally or physically. But I would say that according to all the books of political philosophy that I've read, there's hardly much mention of emotional harm or emotional hurt. It's always physical harm. As long as you're not physically harmed, then all is well and good. And we trust that you'll all be rational, moral adults to do the right thing. We trust this. It's always a trust that as long as human beings aren't being oppressed, they will naturally do the right thing, which again is the Enlightenment, the basis of the Enlightenment, which again is the opposite from Christianity, which says that all human beings are prone to sin. So the Enlightenment is reactionary against Christianity. Whereas, why not someone say that human beings are just basically neutral? We can do bad, we can do quote-unquote good. We are essentially a tabula rasa in that sense, and it depends as to which where our interests lie, the system we live in, and the choices we make, whether we are a good or a bad person. Not necessarily the fact that we live under a free society or an oppressive society that controls whether we are good or bad. I just want to finish with one last point. The thing about the sign that is taken for granted, which again I wanted to bring up and put the discussion progress it further, is that, well, see, religion, there's different religions, so how can we reconcile the different religions, and we want, you know, we can't all agree, so let's have secularism as the default. Who says it's the default? Why not communism the default? Or should we say ideological theism, which in my case I'd say it's Islam. But why not say that's the fault? It's a comprehensive way of life and it caters for different other religions.
I think precisely, we'll leave that sort of moral philosophy stuff behind. But in that distinction that you made, that's precisely why secularism should be this sort of default assumption. Obviously, you have to still get to it, you have to argue to it, so it's not default in the sense that it's obvious, but in the sense that it is a minimal set of rules for engaging in the public space, as opposed to a comprehensive system of life. I don't really think it makes sense to talk about. I mean, so, you know, the one approach to a sort of radical political notion of Islam is to say that, you know, it's just one approach and not kind of words into anyone's mouth, is to say that, you know, there's a derivation from the Quran of particular rules for society. This forms a comprehensive system that we can put into operation to effectively define the whole of society, that we cannot make laws ourselves because we're people and we need God to make the laws, those can be put in place. That creates not just a minimal space, but a comprehensive prefixed set of laws that can't really be changed or modified. They're already there. Now, I think, obviously, for all the reasons I mentioned before, I think that this is going to completely fly in the face of human nature, of our autonomy, that in practice, even if you say, you know, there is space in that society for an open secularism, that in practice, that we've clearly seen that doesn't happen when people try and instantiate theocratic states at all. You talked about there being so many different secularisms. I think there are a few different modalities of secularism, certainly, but there are a lot more different interpretations. of each religion, and you can't, we talk about sort of Sharia law as if, or certainly this particular type of radical political Islamism talks about sort of the Sharia law. We could put it in place, we could have a really good Islamic State. We haven't done it, but no one else has done it before. The fact that there's been them in Afghanistan, Bahrain, and Brunei, and Iran, and Mauritius, and Oman, and Pakistan, and Yemen, and Saudi Arabia, the fact that we did try it, it has been tried, and you never quite have, no one's quite happy to say, oh yeah, no, I agree, that is the Muslim state that I would have built based on Sharia laws. But there is obviously a multitudinous plethora of interpretations within sects, within Islam, just as there is than other religions, trying to pick one and saying this is not only coherent in and of itself, but allows us to establish a sufficiently coherent set of civic laws to live by, I think isn't just sort of philosophically a problem, but it's always already been demonstrably historically shown not to work.
Okay, 5 minutes, gentlemen.
Okay. Well, see, it's very interesting, because you said there are different schools of thought. There are lots of different schools of thought within Islam and so on, a very diverse, and there's a plurality of schools and so on, and I guess I would argue that that actually supports the argument, because Islam historically has managed to support plurality of thought amongst itself. We didn't have any inquisition to say, well, you are heretics, you are not heretics. We didn't have a formed church or mosque and so on. So in a way, all that shows is with Islam rather, is that we had a wonderful history of accommodating people's opinion. Just like in a secular system, you have different types of secularists. There are hundreds of different denominations, sub-denominations. You can have egalitarianists, those who believe in equality of the law, those who believe in equal opportunity, which is slightly different to what you might think it means, equality of outcome, or the equality of condition, which is socialists like, gender equality, racial equality, and social equality, which means the equal access to the things of the earth and equal responsibility, which again is not necessarily what you might think it means, social equality. There are, like, I think, at least 7 different types of equality, schools of thought on equality alone, let alone the concepts of justice, let alone the other concepts of, I mean, the concept of modernist, postmodernist. You have, you know, anarchists, you have libertarians, you have, libertarians, classical liberals, conservatives, you have some different parties. That the political system is composed of just different parties all vying with each other for power. So, having a plurality of opinion has never been a problem for any system, ever. So long as you have a way by which you can, by which each party has an equal right or ability to access power.
But if you've set up a theocratic state based on Sharia law, for example, as one type of theocracy, then by definition of having done that, it seems that you've said, well, there are certain aspects of the state, of the civic body, that are not accessible to that kind of open debate and revision that characterises the interplay that you've just been talking about. If you seal certain things off, above and beyond this sort of minimal level that enables secular interaction, and say, yeah, but fundamentally all the laws have to be derivable from Sharia or something like that, then, well, you've already cut off a vast, vast swathe of possible opinions. And that's the problem. It's all very well, I mean, it's exactly the kind of thing you were saying before, that you're sort of effectively forcing people to either mask the contribution that they make or effectively disallowing it off the bat, because if it's not compatible with this, it's not compatible with the state, and the state is constitutionally obliged to reject someone who says, well, you know what, maybe we should have equality for homosexuals. You know, but what happens then to that argument under laws based on Sharia? Is that something that you could make as an argument in perfectly secular open terms that don't rely on, you know, some intangible notion like a soul, something that we can all share, and would it be able to change?
No, you know what? No, I totally agree. But that was my point, that secularism, to be a secularist, or to implement secularism, you have to adopt a particular political system by which no other political systems, which are adequate to it, can exist simultaneously. And their basis will be rejected by that system. And that's fine. As long as secularists are open about this, then that's fine. So now we can say that there are multiple political systems, and they each are mutually exclusive in terms of you have to approach that political system from its own basis in order to discharge certain affairs. Although Islam is very different, because it allows the Christian and the Jew to have their own law courts according to their own law systems under what I'd call Islamic multiculturalism, which It doesn't impose an absolute set of values over all different religions and beliefs. Rather, it says, okay, you can have your autonomous zone, like the Turkish, Ottoman Turkish millet system.
Or the British Arbitration Act.
What, during the Islamic Empire?
No, last year.
Oh, yes. As I said, during the
Islamic tribunals to cover Sharia courts. I mean, it's an exact, obviously, a very controversial example, and it certainly would come up against some of these more extreme difficulties.
But the failed state issue, you said about there are different failed states in the Muslim world, failed Islamic states. Well, I mean, I just give a very simple answer back to everyone that brings that to me. Very simple. The caliphate of the medieval ages, the Islamic caliphate, which was in Spain and sort of throughout the Middle East and so on, compare that to Saudi Arabia and the Taliban. Are they the same? You know, in system-wise, forget about technology, system-wise, are they the same? You had more, within the caliphate system, there were certain the individuals and people had rights. The caliph couldn't spy against people, your house was your sanctity and so on. And heck, you could even be homosexual in your own house. And that's okay, because the issue is this open society. It's the open society. And in this society, you can't be openly homosexual, as in you can't have a homosexual sex in public. You see, in this society as well. Or heterosexual sex, same thing. So you have rights in the Islamic Caliphate back then in history, and I will challenge anyone to compare the Islamic Caliphate of history, which existed, was a proven example, was successful and progressive, with the failed examples of today, whereby they are kings or tribal leaders or people who are implementing part culture, part a modicum of Islamic laws, and calling themselves or dressing up in an Islamic attire just so they can have some legitimacy, when everyone under their country says that they're not Islamic. And these people that say that are imprisoned and locked up.
Can I ask you just one question, perhaps, to finish this off? If you said under the caliphate, I could be homosexual even in my own home. Let's say I'm living in the caliphate, let's say I'm homosexual. Can I be homosexual outside of my home? Can I hold hands with my boyfriend?
If you know anything about Arab culture, just even two mates hold hands. So, do you know what?
So it wouldn't protect that point very
much,
perhaps?
Soundly speaking, essentially, there is no definition of the concept of homosexual. Like, there's a race of people called homosexuals or, you know, group. Rather, it's just the action itself. So as long as you're not having homosexual sex in public, then there's absolutely nothing you to fit, even if you was to wear a big shirt with pink saying I'm Campbell.
I look forward to the gay adoption agencies in the future caliphate.
Right, on that note, I'd like to thank both our speakers for a fascinating debate. We now have a 10-minute break.